Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to share today. We're going to talk about how yoga improves arthritis symptoms and mood. And that is a good study from John Hopkins School of Medicine. And researchers explore how cacao or chocolate is good for cognitive deterioration in Alzheimer's disease from Icahn's School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and how red wine ingredient can affect the progression of Alzheimer's from Georgetown University, and how jumbo portions lead to overeating from University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom, and more. We're also going to have a commentary. Commentary today is from John Whitehead, and from Op-Ed News, on public school students are the new inmates in the American police state. How also hero or coward could skipping my student loan payments start a revolution? From Yes Magazine, Yashina Funes, and from Christina Sarich, microbiological scientist, says that biotechnology is like a religion, and it's failing. My guest in the second part of our program is Dr. Gary Coles, a medical doctor, and we're going to talk about the failures and crimes of big psychiatry. Also, time permitting, we'll take a look at a few other issues, including policing for profit, the abuse of civil asset forfeiture, how they can stop you when you're driving anywhere. Take everything. Take your car. You've committed no crime. They have no evidence you have committed a crime. And yet it's one of the biggest and what many of us consider most contemptible challenges to our freedom. They're the police. They've been militarized. Everyone sticks together, the district attorneys, the judges. They're all corrupt, in my opinion. And I trust none, because they're making $4 billion last year of taking innocent people's homes, businesses, cars, and cash. And I guess that's just the new norm. We shrug our shoulders and say, well, as long as it wasn't me, why should I care? Why should you care? Well, we should, and that'll be addressed. And how the CIA kills countries, John Perkins and George Carlin on stuff. So we have a lot on our plate today. Let's begin with what most people have on their plate: too much food. I've commented upon the Exotic Foods channel, where this person runs around the world and eating all strange things, none of it healthy, and a lot of it from animals and creatures. And the person, certainly from my own personal observation, should be on a healthy program. But people enjoy things that are bizarre, unusual, out of the ordinary. And that's one program. But the most, in my opinion, personal opinion, the most dangerous program on television is not the reality shows. They're just stupid. But rather the shows that promote eating huge amounts of unhealthy food. And they're very popular. More importantly, they set a standard. So when you go into a city now, you ask about the restaurants that serve huge portions, far beyond supersized portions, jumbo portions. And then other restaurants, in order to compete with that restaurant that starts serving large stacks of pancakes or huge amounts of meat on a platter, they compete. So everybody raises their portion size, until a normal portion is no longer seen as adequate. This is in the University of Cambridge, Cambridge University, and it says, quote, larger portions and oversized tableware do contribute to overeating. Eliminating a jumbo servings of foods and beverages could reduce caloric intake among Americans by 29%. Helping people to avoid overserving themselves or others with larger portions of food and drink by reducing their size. Availability and appeal in shops, restaurants, and at home is likely to be a good way of helping lots of people to reduce their risk of overeating. And that's according to Dr. Hollins, the chief researcher in this study. Now, here's my thoughts on this. And this was published in the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews. I recently had a health retreat. And normally we have a table set up where people come through and they're served. And they can go back for whatever amount of food they want, because these are not high caloric dense foods. To the contrary, they're very modest in calories because they're living foods. They're gourmet. This time we did it differently. We plated every dish, and that means beautiful presentations were done with each and every dish. And we intentionally spaced the time between portions so no one had to rush. What was interesting is how quickly people consumed each dish, where you should take your time, relax, enjoy the waterfalls, enjoy nature, enjoy beautiful flute music. Instead, in 4 minutes, they were through a dish. And the salads were particularly large. I mean, they filled a whole plate, and maybe 3 inches high. In and of themselves, they were a meal. And these were not just lettuces, all forms of peppers and sun-dried tomatoes and wonderful sauces. In any case, I base it upon what I see a person's body needs. But if you have a very big person, let's say they're morbidly obese, they tend to eat as if they have to feed a morbidly obese body. Well, if you ask the person, what are you eating for? They say, well, I'm hungry. Well, that also is controlled by your size. If you're used to eating a huge portion of food and you eat only half of that portion, you will feel that you're deprived and your brain will say, I'm still hungry. So hence, eating smaller portions but more of them and taking your time, you can negate that sense of feeling lacking satiety. You'll feel full. Now also, not having beverages with meals is good as well. And instead, have your beverage before a meal or have your beverage after a meal, unless the beverage is the meal. And what was interesting is people who are used to huge portions, because they were quiet, no talking, they were relaxed, they were at ease, their satiety was complete, meaning they had no hunger. And yet, calorically, they were probably eating half the calories they would normally eat, because it's all vegan and a lot of it's living foods, which are low calorie, and that's what you want. You want low calorie. You do not want fat or protein or calorie dense foods like meat or refined carbohydrates like a pizza. It's loaded with calories. And or a soft drink loaded with calories. You could have 12 teaspoons of sugar in a single soft drink. Instead, you had juices like fresh organic lemons juice or fresh watermelon juice, which is actually low in calories, but cleansing the body. And a small group of people, probably around 10, would eat and then go out later to fast food restaurants and eat, which defeats the whole purpose. None of these people were healthy, by the way, nor were these the people likely to do yoga or to pay attention to many of the lectures. I don't know why they were there, quite frankly. But the people who wanted to change did, and I've gotten all these positive letters of people who said, I didn't realize that I've been overeating until I saw what a proper food portion should be. So the takeaway message is, do not get your information about how you should eat from television or infomercials or someone promoting a particular dietary project like the paleo diet or the high protein diet or the South Beach diets. These are good for their advocates. They make them money and fame. They are not necessarily then good for you. And But when you're eating a whole grain, you're eating beans, you're filling your body up with nutrients, and you're not going to overeat. And if you get used to serving smaller portion sizes, no matter what it is, instead of huge bowls, small bowls, instead of bowls, cups. I call it grazing through a day, where what you eat is not a lot. For example, give you a specific. Let's say that you have some hummus. Now, hummus you can make yourself with chickpeas, some lemon juice, some Himalayan sea salt, some garlic, cayenne pepper, some black pepper. And you blend that together. You can put some extra virgin olive oil in it. And it makes a beautiful, almost like a pate. And then you could take some slivers of red sweet pepper. And you dip the red sweet pepper sliver into the hummus, and you have maybe three or four of those. It's not a lot, just enough to create satiety. So your brain gets used to saying, I've had enough. Maybe at another point in the day you have an apple. Maybe you have some pieces of papaya at a different point. You might have an avocado, and you can take the avocado. You can do anything with the avocado. You can blend it with other herbs and then stuff it into mushroom, and then have yourself a nice big portobello mushroom. You can saute the portobello mushroom with some toasted sesame oil lightly, and then put the avocado as a paste with whatever your favorite seasoning. Maybe it is tarragon, or maybe it's rosemary, or maybe it's coriander, and you mix it with it, and you put it on it. So you're just getting enough to tease the taste buds, but it's creating satiety, and it's all healing. It's all good. It's low calories. And that way you don't have to sit down to big meals. So this idea of grazing throughout the day on healthy things, for example, making a big protein shake in the morning, and in that protein shake you put your essential fatty acids from nuts, pine nuts, macadamia nuts, walnuts, pistachios, which are very healthy, but I'm talking about the raw form, not the cooked in oil and salt. And you throw those in, you throw berries in, you throw your vegetable-based, plant-based protein powders in, and probiotics in, and vitamin C in, and concentrates to really spike it, your vegetable concentrate, your fruit concentrates. And then throughout the day, you have like 6 ounces. Now, 6 ounces of a protein shake is giving you about 15 grams of quality protein. So if you had 3 of those a day, you've had your entire daily requirement of protein with 3 low-calorie shakes. And if you are pregnant, if you're lactating, if you're recovering from surgery, if you're a bodybuilder and you want more protein, fine, then put in some almond butter, and that will give you extra protein as well. So now you're getting everything your body possibly wants, but you're not getting empty calories, denatured calories, devitalized food. And that's what most people are eating. And they're eating a lot of it. And now they're not just eating a lot of it. They're eating humongous amounts of it. And that leads now to what? Morbid obesity. There was recently a comedian, actress, who did a put down of people who are overweight. I watched it. I found that it was insulting. It was insensitive. And the argument is, yes, but it was true. Yes, it was true. But it was also insensitive. You can be honest without being insensitive. It's like being funny and having to be vulgar being funny. You can be funny without being vulgar. You just have to be a little smarter, a little more creative. It doesn't take any genius just to be vulgar, because people are laughing in part out of the nervousness of the tone of your voice as well as the words you're using. So I would much prefer watching the Marx Brothers, the W.C. Fields, who were absolutely magical in how they would skewer society and its morals. But they did it with cleverness. I would say this to those of you who are overweight. You're fully aware you're overweight. No one has to remind you. You're fully aware of what you feel about yourself. You don't have to read a book on psychology of eating disorders. You know what your problem is. What you frequently lack is a support system to help you during a time in your life where positive encouragement and exercise and helping to eat right could make a big difference. I would much rather see people who have a problem with their weight seek the help that they need from people who are there to give them the support without mocking or ridiculing or gossiping about them. It's like going up to someone who has no eyes and saying, gee, you're blind. Of course, it's self-evident. But be there to support the person, not to put them down. We've become a society of too many people feeling it's their right to mock, ridicule, and condemn people. And I don't find it humorous, and I don't find it relevant, even if it's popular on the internet. But the fact is, a lot of things popular on the internet are lacking class and taste. What we need is a national program to help people deal with the issues of weight, which also means dealing with the issues of life and self and self-confidence and self-value and self-esteem, and which area of their life are they going to focus upon and how will that support their change, and helping them nurture a sense of self-discipline with self-love. I've never seen a person I could get healthy if I also couldn't help them get happy, because the foundation of all health is happiness, and happiness is always in us in abundance if we simply know how to open that lock, being at the right time, with the right ideas, with the right support system, and being the right person. And suddenly, we realize we don't have to work outside of ourselves for happiness. It's already there. And then watch the excess weight melt away. I've seen it thousands of times. Next, could red wine, an ingredient in it, affect the progression of Alzheimer's? Georgetown University, quote, high doses of resveratrol, a compound found in red wine and berries, may have activity against Alzheimer's disease, according to clinical trial. Now, we know already what. We know that resveratrol is a powerful antioxidant. We know that it produces a healing benefit in the body. We also know that red wine would be the last place we should get it because it's in the tiny amounts. In fact, the amount that I would suggest and that I recommend to help people with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's would be the equivalent of drinking 1,000 bottles a day. Well, no one's going to drink one bottle of wine a day, let alone 1,000. Why not just take the supplement? You're much better off. But this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology, and offers the evidence that high dose, quote, pharmaceutical grade resveratrol can get into the brains of people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's. Well, they're promoting the idea that you have to have it as a drug. I'm saying you do not. There is no difference between resveratrol that is used medically and resveratrol that is used commercially. It is the same resveratrol. Just use it on a daily basis. Researchers are also, according to the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, exploring cacao as a dietary source to prevent cognitive deterioration and Alzheimer's disease. And what do we know about cocoa? What do we know about chocolate? We know that chocolate, especially the darker chocolate, and the healthier chocolate, it contains polyphenols, and that's the key, poly, P-O-L-Y, phenols, P-H-E-N-O-L-S. That's what makes it powerful. These are micronutrients, meaning they're in small amounts, but they have extraordinary benefits to our health, and they affect the brain. They turn off inflammation in the brain, and they help promote brain health and help prevent cognitive dysfunction. I saw someone last night in a restaurant. This is a very famous person who is suffering from advanced cognitive decline. Unfortunately, there is nothing this person is doing because they no longer can control their actions, and the members of their family have chosen not to help them with a holistic protocol. I've known this person for a long time, and it's sad to see it because they won't recognize you sometimes, or if they recognize you, they won't remember anything they have shared in the past, any conversations. I've even seen people with advanced cognitive decline in a restaurant, after they finished eating, order again. They're not aware they just ate. That is how bad cognitive decline can be. Suddenly they'll look around in a room and say, "Where am I?" They're not aware of where they're at. And this could be in their own home. Or they'll look at someone saying, "Who are you?" Not realizing it could be a family member. So once you've been around people who have cognitive decline and Alzheimer's, it's serious. According to an MD-PhD professor of neurology at the School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, they believe that chocolate can make a big difference, and especially with Alzheimer's disease. And this was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So the takeaway message is this. There's healthy chocolate and there's unhealthy chocolate. Healthy chocolate tells you what percentage is chocolate. And the ideal, if you really want to do it as good as it can get, it would be 85%. Beyond that, it would be too bitter for most people to consume. Non-dairy and no processed sugars. If it wants to be sweetened with a natural sugar, the best natural sugars be cocoa sugar with low glycemic index and cane juice that is organic, cane juice, the actual juice that is simply sun-dried, or a stevia, and that would be fine. And to have 2 ounces of that a day would make a big difference. 2 ounces is a small amount, and that would help them. And finally, yoga improves arthritis symptoms and mood. This is from John Hopkins School of Medicine, and it says, quote, "Study finds that yoga may be a safe and effective way to keeping moving for the 1 in 5 adults who live with arthritis. In a randomized trial, people with arthritis who practiced yoga had about 20% improvement in physical health with similar improvements in pain, energy, mood, and carrying out day-to-day activities and tasks." So that's good. Now imagine then if they got off all pro-inflammatory foods. Pizzas, hot dogs, hamburgers, pretzels, bagels, donuts, coffee, alcohol, and sugar, and started to consume a healthy plant-based diet, and then took the nutrients that are known to help with pain, such as cayenne and the omega-3 fatty acids, also the monounsaturated fatty acids like olive oil, and the B-complex, and pantothenic acid, and vitamin D, and vitamin C with quercetin. Those also help with pain. We're going to take a break and be right back. Please stay with us. Your feedback on this to see how you would come on this particular issue, either for it or against it. This is from Yes Magazine. This is from Yesenia Funes, and a college professor is calling for a massive student debt strike next year with only one necessity, that as many debtors as possible refuse to pay their debt. The article is entitled "Hero or Coward? Could Skipping My Student Loan Payments Start a Revolution?" Quote, "Every college semester, I filled out my financial aid application hoping I would receive more grants than loans. Either way, my fate was sealed. I was a college student in the United States, so debt was inevitable. The latest figures from the U.S. Department of Education show in my second year of college that tuition, room, board, and other expenses are $15,022 a year at a public institution, $39,173 at private nonprofit institutions, and $23,000 at private for-profit institutions. By the way, these are not Ivy Leagues. Most students spend at least 4 years. No aspiring college graduate I know of has $60,000 lying around for 4 years of public college, let alone almost three times that for a private one. This has led to one of the U.S.'s most crippling debts, $1.3 trillion worth of it. As for me, I'm below average. I'm holding $23,000 in debt after 2 years. Now, and then this person says, a class I took last year addressed my option. My professor, Richard Robbins, a distinguished professor of anthropology, proposed a debt strike. He's calling for at least a 20 to 25% of people to ignore their October 2016 debt bills. Quote, not pay my bills. I thought it sounded radical. But as he discusses in his forthcoming book, Debt as Power, co-authored with Tim DeMuzio, it's not that radical. He says he has a solution to our debt problem. The question is, will I, or yet will we, take a chance on it? First off, I had to understand his idea more clearly, so I sat down with him, had a conversation with him, and he explained that why he was suggesting it. In a labor strike, employees refuse to work. They could, but they're saying they won't until their demands are met. The factory can't run until its employees return. The employer needs the strikers, so it's forced to hear them out. Well, creditors need debtors, too. They rely upon us. They give us money so we can make them even more money. They don't lend us money to be good Samaritans. They're running a business that relies entirely on people borrowing their money and then paying it back with interest. Debtors keep the economy system afloat. In Robin's words, debtors are cultural heroes. So in a debt strike, the heroes would use their now realized power and refuse to make the villains more money. The strikers have the money to make payments, but they're choosing to ignore the payments, at least until their demands are met. Hearing all this inspired me, then it concerned me. What about my credit rating? In a perfect world, that wouldn't matter, but in our credit-driven world, it does. If the strike goes as planned and as good as 20 to 25% of debtors participate, Robin says no one can be penalized. That would be absurd. The number would be too vast, and creditors don't want to ruin their customers' credit, especially the ones who can afford to pay back their debt. So, here is the question for the audience on our talkback. What do you believe should be the solution to the vast and crippling student debt? And remember, here's how it works. In our society today, you cannot get out of your debt. You can't go into bankruptcy. The legislators working with, including Chris Dodd of Connecticut, working with the bankers, made sure that you can't discharge your debt, student debt, through bankruptcy. Also, they can continue to charge you if you don't work, can't work, are injured, it doesn't matter. And now they have private prisons, and they have a task force of people to serve you summons, to arrest you for non-payment of debt, including SWAT teams, and that break down your door and come in. That actually happened in California to a woman who was 6 months behind on her debt. And now in these private prisons, they are debtors' prisons, even though it's officially no longer allowed to be a debtors' prison in the United States. We have debtors' prisons. Also, we have to think of how many people in good times signed those loans, parents or even grandparents, assuming that historically you'd pay back your loan in a short period of time. now these people are having their own salaries or wages or pensions garnished, and they also have had to put themselves into harm's way and frequently go broke or have to sell their homes to pay back student debt. You also have multiple people, 55% of the last 5 years worth of students living at home. You also have, for the first time in my life, you have people in their 40s and 50s, whole families, moving back with their parents because they've lost jobs, they've lost homes, and they're racked with debt, including their own kids' student debt. So you see the rippling effect of not being able to pay off your debt. And then no one is questioning schools like New York University or any of the other schools that have massive endowments into the billions of dollars and are growing by buying up real estate and creating campuses in Abu Dhabi and other countries, and they're using slave labor, and that's been exposed and fully documented, and paying their full faculty professors a lot and paying their adjuncts nothing, so to speak, and putting it all on the back of the student. And hence the student wanting to go to the more prestigious schools as if that in and of itself would guarantee them a better chance of a job. It doesn't. Or that somehow they'll be perceived as smarter. They aren't. The same academic standards are upheld universally. And this is what most people don't understand. And that means that once your school is accredited, it has to be accredited based upon the same identical standards of all schools in that particular district, whether it's the Midwestern school or the Northeastern school. So you can't have one standard of accreditation for Harvard and another one for Columbia. They're all identical. Now, that does not mean that all teaching is identical. Clearly, it is not. Nor that all facilities are identical. They're not. But the fact that you have expensive auditoriums, or you have Olympic swimming pools, or you have special incentives does not mean that you're getting a better education. You're just paying more. So what's wrong with vocational schools? What's wrong with two-year schools? What's wrong with no school and doing something where you can apply skills and attitude as you see fit until such time that you could afford to go to school? Why can't you delay school if there's no guarantee for most graduates that you're going to be able to work in the field of your specialization and at a standard that would repay back your loan and give you a quality of life and a standard of living? There is none, with very few exceptions. So how should we proceed? I have my ideas, but I'm interested in yours. Call TalkBack at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear your input on that. Now, I've mentioned many times on this program that I believe that we are now full force into a police state, a totalitarian standard of identifying people based upon whether they are perceived as a threat to society, those who are the critical thinkers, those who have joined different causes, those who speak out against either the corporate the corporate corruption or the government malfeasance. We may still have a First Amendment, but look at how we don't have a Fourth Amendment. Look at how so many individuals have had no sanctuary from search and seizures, who've been stopped, frisked. And now it's into the school system, and it's heavily into the school system. And according to John Whitehead, in this new American police state, you're either a prisoner, meaning you're shackled, controlled, monitored, ordered about, limited in what you can do and say. In effect, your life is not your own. Or you're a prison bureaucrat, like a police officer, a judge, or a jailer, or a spy, or a profiteer, or you're a person in between the two, meaning you have not yet been affected. And that's because you're not taking an issue forward, put yourself at risk. But if we never put ourselves at risk, how can we ever address anything honestly that is wrong with society? Are we the people that hide, look out the window as others protest, as others challenge authority when the authority is wrong, and hope that it all goes away and nobody will pay attention to us? When you're a child in the American police state, life is much worse. microcosms of the police state in American public schools contain almost every aspect of the militarized, intolerant, senseless, overcriminalized, legalistic, surveillance-riddled, totalitarian landscape that plagues those of us who have not yet been affected. From the moment a child enters one of the nation's 98,000 public schools to the moment they graduate, they will be exposed to a steady diet of draconian zero-tolerance policies that criminalize childish behavior, or overreaching anti-bullying statutes that criminalize speech, and school resource officers, that's the police, they're tasked with disciplining or arresting so-called disorderly students. You already have standardized testing, in my opinion, completely meaningless, because it convinces the parents and the student that you need to emphasize rote answers over critical thinking and politically correct mindsets that teach young people to censor themselves and those around them, and extensive biometric and surveillance systems that, coupled with the rest, acclimate young people to a world in which they have no freedom of thought, speech, or movement. If your child is fortunate enough to survive that encounter with the public schools, then they are the exception. Most students are not so lucky. By the time the average young person in America finishes their public school education, nearly one out of three of them will have been arrested. More than 3 million students are suspended or expelled from school every year. That is substantial for disruptive behavior or insubordination. For instance, a Virginia sixth grader, the son of two school teachers and a member of the school's gifted program, was suspended for a year from school when officials found a maple leaf in his backpack that they suspected was marijuana, despite the fact that the leaf in question was not marijuana, and they later said they knew that immediately. The 11-year-old was still kicked out of school, charged with marijuana possession in juvenile court, enrolled in an alternative school away from his friends, subjected to twice daily searches for drugs, and forced to be evaluated for substance abuse problems, even though everyone in the system knew that this was not correct. Under similarly misguided school zero-tolerance policies, students have been suspended for bringing to school household spices like oregano, a birth control, or even powdered sugar, look-alike weapons, toy guns, even hand-drawn pictures of guns, twirling pencils is considered threatening within schools. Imaginary bows and arrows. Even if you point your finger like a gun, you can get kicked out of school. Acts of kindness, concern, or basic manners can also result in suspensions. One 13-year-old was given detention for exposing the school to liability by sharing his lunch with a hungry friend who had no lunch. A third grader was suspended for shaving her head in sympathy for a friend who had lost her hair to chemotherapy. But she was suspended. And then there was the high school senior who was suspended for saying "bless you" after a fellow classmate sneezed. Unfortunately, these incidents are indicative of a nationwide phenomenon in which children are treated like suspects and criminals, especially within the public schools. And when you bring the police into the picture, and we've seen how insensitive most police are, after-school detention and visits to the principal's office are transformed into punishments such as misdemeanor tickets, juvenile court, handcuffs, tasers, and even prison terms. And more police are stepping in to deal with minor rule-breaking, sagging pants, disrespectful comments, brief physical skirmishes. What previously might have resulted in a detention or a visit to the principal's office was replaced by excruciating pain and temporary blindness, often followed by a trip to the courthouse. Thanks to a combination of media hype, thank Bill O'Reilly, thank Sean Hannity, thank all of the fascist Fox Network people, but also ask where are the good Democratic liberals who've been supporting these policies without question, even promoting them, including the Clintons and Obama. And speaking of the Clintons last night on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I did a one-hour, very comprehensive look at Hillary and Bill Clinton even before he became president. Go to the archives and listen to the Progressive Commentary Hour on Clinton and see, is this the kind of person, based upon their character and actions, that you would want to be the most powerful person in the world? Now, we have advocates for such harsh police tactics and weaponry will tell you that school safety should be our first priority, lest we find ourselves with another Sandy Hook. This is nonsense. In their zeal to crack down on guns and lock down the schools, these cheerleaders for police state tactics in the schools might also fail to mention the lucrative multi-million dollar deals that are in place, being cut with military contractors such as Taser International to equip these school cops with tasers and tanks and rifles and $100,000 shooting detection systems. Indeed, the transformation of hometown police departments into extensions of the military has been mirrored in public schools, where schools' police have been gifted with high-powered M16 rifles, MRAP armored vehicles, grenade launchers, and other military gear. One Texas school district even boasts its own 12-member SWAT team. As if it weren't bad enough that the nation's schools have become the resemblance of prisons, complete with surveillance cameras, metal detectors, drug-sniffing dogs, random locker searches, and active shooter drills, the government is also contracting with private prisons to lock up young people for behavior that once would have merited only a stern lecture. Nearly 40% of those young people who are arrested will serve time in a prison that is private, where the emphasis is on making profits for large mega corporations above all else. Young people have become easy targets for the private prison industry. For instance, two Pennsylvania judges made headlines, and I discussed this on our program a year ago, when they conspired with two businessmen in a $2.6 million Kids for Cash scandal that resulted in more than 2,500 young children being found guilty and jailed for profit prisons. It's been said that America's schools are the training ground for future generations. Well, is that true? Then take a look at what's going on in our schools and then project ahead. What an abysmal future that is. I'm Gary Nall, and I want to take a few calls on our talk back before we go to our guest, but we're going to take a break first. If you'd like to ask or make your comments on your suggestions before we go to our guest, Dr. Gary Coles, call 888-874-4888. At the time, and I'm going to hold off taking calls because I want to give more time to my guests. It's an important topic. We had a lot of people yesterday heard about the upcoming Peace and Prosperity Conference and rally. I'm going to be there Saturday, this coming Saturday. It's at the Trends Research Institute at 42 Crown Street in Kingston, New York, right in the center of the town. Exit 19 off the New York Thruway. It's about an hour and 40 minutes from Manhattan. And then we're going to have a rally to launch Occupy Peace on Sunday. Also starting in Colonial Kingston, we'll have Ralph Nader, Professor Robert Thurman, Gerald Salante, Cindy Sheehan, and Paul Craig Roberts, and myself. So it'll be an interesting 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, in Kingston. And you can go to the Trends Research to get more information. Look forward to seeing some of you there. Let's say hello to Dr. Gary Coles, K-O-H-L-S. He is a family practitioner specializing in holistic, non-drug, and preventative mental health care for the last decade of his career. He has expertise in the areas of traumatic stress disorders, brain malnutrition, non-pharmaceutical approaches to mental health and neurotransmitter disorders, and neurotoxicities from psychotropic drugs and vaccines and environmental toxins. And he's written extensively on these, and I'll let you get his website from him in a moment. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you, Gary. You make me wish I was out there in New York to attend the rally this weekend. Sounds great.
I'd like to hear your assessment and review of the psychiatric profession today, which is becoming exceedingly more psychiatric drug-based and ignoring nutritional and psychosomatic or behavioral therapy approaches, even in tandem. And after many years of seeing patients who come to you with severe psychological conditions and on drug prescription regimens, what has been your observations on how the psychiatric profession treats patients and how we are moving to a completely pill-based paradigm for treating mental disorders and even physical disorders?
Yeah, it's really a sad state of affairs. My practice consisted of an independent practice, totally unrelated to a major clinic, for-profit clinic. So I was able to not have people looking over my shoulder and demanding that I see 30 people in a day, et cetera. So I was able to do what I always knew I needed to do when I was a physician doing the medical care at a mental institution in the late 90s, where I saw that the inpatients there were all victims of psychological, sexual, spiritual trauma, and then had been falsely labeled as being permanently mentally ill, whereas they only had temporary deteriorations in mental faculties, et cetera, or they were neurologically toxic. And then they were placed on drugs which made their conditions worse or created a brand new condition of drug intoxication and dependency on the medications. And eventually they became disabled, unable to earn a living, and became dependent on the state and had to continue their medications. So I knew that there was something seriously wrong with the diagnoses of mental illness, the incarceration of the mentally ill, which was usually on the basis of the medications that they had been given, and the difficulty with that these patients had in trying to get off of the addictive toxic substance that they knew were sickening them. So I was basically dealing with psychiatric survivors of psychiatry. And the patients themselves had made attempts, knowing that they were being sickened by these drugs, made attempts to get off the meds, and then they would go through withdrawal, because all of the five types of psychiatric medications, the psychostimulants, the antidepressants, the sleeping pills, these antipsychotics, and the mood alterers, they all are dependency-inducing and therefore addictive, and therefore when a person has been on them for any certain length of time, they will have difficulty going through withdrawal symptoms, which can be very serious, make them look crazy, and sometimes solidify the diagnosis, because when they were going off their drugs, they were told their mental illness was coming back, rather than the truth of the matter is that they were going through withdrawal from the dependency-inducing drugs that doctors had prescribed. So because the patients had usually tried to go off the meds themselves without any real help or knowledge, and I was able to devise a system which was very time-consuming and not very profitable. I was very profitable from a professional standpoint, but not from an economic standpoint, because I had to spend an hour with every patient in follow-up after having a 90-minute first visit. So I developed a system then to teach the patient that their initial diagnoses were in error, that they almost always, in my experience, had post-traumatic stress disorder, which is more of a neurological illness than a mental illness, since the cortisol levels alter the air, toxic to the brain, especially when there's chronic elevations of cortisol, which is in response to chronic stress. And they're also, on the basis of their chronic stress or neglect, having brain damage from the elevated adrenaline levels. That's brain toxic also when it's two hormones are chronically elevated. But then they were also sick from the medications, which cause deterioration in the brain, synapses, the receptor sites, reuptake pumps, etc. But because the psychiatric drugs, and this isn't very well recognized by physicians, they mess up the normal neurotransmitters, which come from amino acids and therefore from diet. That's the only way you can increase neurotransmitters is by eating the proteins that have the amino acids in them that raise natural antidepressants such as serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine. So brain nutrition was the thing that nobody had tried. And so I added a lot of the things you have written about in your great books, which I applaud you, by the way, I have them, the encyclopedia, etc., that recommends certain brain nutrients to help the brain malnourished patients who have had depletions because of the drugs, drug-induced depletions of certain neurotransmitters. So by supplementing them or replenishing those neurotransmitters, I was able to more readily get the patients through the withdrawal symptoms, because when a person's been on an addictive drug that has depleted essential neurotransmitters, when they go and screwed up their synapses, their receptor sites and reuptake pumps, then that patient is really in a crazy-making situation because the brain has been altered, brain nutrients depleted, and certain damage being done, and by not simultaneously providing the essential brain nutrients, the vitamins, antioxidants, omega-3 fatty acids, and amino acids, the patient, my patients were able to tolerate the withdrawal syndrome and get off the drugs much more comfortably without having the severe withdrawal symptoms. So that's, so since my retirement from this practice 7 years ago or so, I have continued to learn more. I wish I had known what I know now back when I was treating patients, but I'm continuing to try to educate the public through my writings.
Okay, and those writings can be seen at Duluth, D-U-L-U-T-H, reader.com. I think it's important for us to know that the federal advisory groups, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, is now urging doctors to screen teenagers for depression. And earlier there was a teen screen being pushed by the Bush White House. That failed, but this appears to be a new resurgence to reach the same goal, which would be to get teens on psychiatric drugs. What are your thoughts about these schemes to psychologically evaluate children and teens, especially when it's a strategy that only fits one model, the conventional medical model, and one of the biggest supporters of that is Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, and of course she was on the board of Eli Lilly, the manufacturers of Prozac. I don't know if she still is, but all of these, you have to go and follow the money, follow the influence. The teen screen was started by the pharmaceutical industry, or the, you know, some aspect of the pharmaceutical industry that was getting money from big pharma. So you know you have to be suspicious of it right away. But those are well-funded, like NAMI was heavily subsidized by the drug industry. CHAD, the one that promotes ADHD diagnoses and medication for so-called ADHD, that was subsidized by the pharmaceutical industry. So most of these so-called patient advocacy groups like Teen Screen or whatever have dirty money behind them, and it's an investment. They know that if they can get more and more people with a label of a mental illness, eventually that patient will filter over to the psychiatrist's office or the internist or the pediatrician's office who can all write these toxic, neurotoxic drugs. Those are devious schemes to just increase market share. And we need to look at, follow the money, like I say, and look at who's behind the promotion. Well, all the Republicans and almost all of the Democrats are also being bribed by big pharma money. The biggest lobby in D.C. is the big pharmaceutical industry lobby. And so they're being bribed to promote and sign and introduce legislation and pass legislation that benefits the people who are the drug companies who are supplying the money for their political campaigns. So it's total travesty. Total travesty.
Okay, I need a real short answer on this because it's our final question. Dr. Coles, do you believe that the psychiatric community, with some exceptions, depending upon how they practice, do you believe it is a legitimate science, or do you believe that it is nothing more than a fraud, for better term?
Yeah, definitely pseudoscience. You know, I've studied the history of how they all of a sudden decided, because psychiatrists were looked down on by the rest of the medical profession, they looked at all the new drugs coming out, and they decided, we can pretend to be scientists by being experts in prescribing these medications. So, total fraud.
Okay.
With some exceptions.
And also, do you see that there is any legitimacy to the brain chemical imbalance theory of mental illness from which 100% of all psychiatric drugs are now prescribed?
Yeah. No. There certainly can be neurotransmitter depletions from the drugs, but it doesn't cause people to be mentally ill. The drugs are what causes people to be mentally ill in many, many cases. So,
okay.
No, there's no good evidence that a neurotransmitter imbalance or whatever is the cause of mental illnesses. That's been totally debunked.
Dr. Gary Coles from Duluth, Minnesota, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome, Gary. Thanks for asking me.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.